Hello and welcome to Carefully Considered, the podcast about caring, the issues unpaid carers face and how we solve them. I'm Katie, an unpaid carer of the We Care campaign, a grassroots organisation empowering unpaid carers to feel visible and valued.
And I'm Laura, also an unpaid carer, and we're here to inform and hopefully entertain you. Each episode, we will be talking to an expert to get their views to see what we can all do to get the change millions of carers across the UK need. But before we do that, as usual, Katie, how are you? What's been happening in your world?
Oh, right. Well, I've got two updates. So, caring-wise, long-time listeners will know I've had an issue with both of my mum's curtains, and now we've got all of the curtains working and all up. So yes, hooray, that is a big thing as far as I'm concerned. And then We Care wise, we have our first ever report coming out, and I am really excited about that because that seems like a major moment.
It's going to be great. I look forward to reading it and probably asking you 5 million questions about it, but that's a different topic. Sorry, Katie. I do like to ask you a lot of questions. But for today, we have a fantastic guest. You've done it again, Katie. Would you mind introducing us?
Our guest today is Mary-Anne Ahotta, a broadcaster and author specialising in anthropology, archaeology and social history. And she's a fellow member of the Royal Geographical Society. Woo! So, welcome to the podcast, Mary-Anne.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for having me. It's a genuine privilege to talk to you guys. You do amazing work. I love the We Care campaign.
Oh, thank you.
Mary-Anne, let's start with the basics because you do a lot of things. How would you introduce yourself to a stranger sitting next to you at a dinner party?
I think I'd probably say it depends whether I wanted to be fancy or not. If I was feeling like I wanted to be fancy, then I'd say that I was a broadcaster and author, probably, or broadcaster and anthropologist, because people go, ooh, what's that? Anthropology is the study of humans in its broadest sense. So it could be kind of evolutionary origins and how we're related to other primates, or it could be more, I guess, sociological or about kind of around social psychology, about how we organise our family, how we understand the world around us. But I also focus on archaeology as well, which from my focus, rather than kind of calibrating radiocarbon dates or, you know, really technical stuff about how to excavate a site, it's more about the kind of the why. So the kind of anthropology of the past. So why were people doing those weird things at Stonehenge, and why, what were they thinking at the time? That kind of stuff. But I'm also, you know, a kind of busy mum. I like going walking. I really enjoy, I have the privilege of, because I'm on TV and do radio and write and stuff, I sometimes have a platform to kind of talk about things that are important to me. And that's the thing that I most enjoy. So it's really lovely to be able to come and chat to you and perhaps hopefully try and amplify some of the messages that you guys are trying to put out as well.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Thank you. So can you tell us a little bit about your career to date? Because you've mentioned being a broadcaster and an anthropologist. And, you know, how did those things combine? And how did you get to where you are today? Because that's quite a leap.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, many people's careers, I guess, are quite convoluted. No one, when they're, I don't know, 13, 14, says to the careers advisor, oh, well, no, I guess maybe kids do now. No one at my school ever did say, I'd like to be a TV presenter, or not to my knowledge anyway. I said that I wanted to do something outside with animals. And there was this very kind of like 1.0 online careers advice kind of database interface thing where you answered a bunch of questions and then out popped an answer, and it told me that I should be a gamekeeper. Anyway, long story short, I kind of convolutedly found my way to social anthropology because I kind of thought, well, the thing that interests me about animals is about animals and nature, about animals and people and our relationship with animals. So kind of via thinking maybe I wanted to train guide dogs and all sorts of other stuff, I ended up going to university to study social anthropology, and it just so happened that I had to study archaeology for a bit of it, and then realised that I actually really like archaeology as well. because it's the anthropology of the past. And basically, you can ask a lot of questions. I'm with you, Laura. Questions are king. I kind of wandered around in my early 20s, partly also because I was actually caring for my grandmother as well, and which kind of was both a tie and a quite a significant time commitment and financial commitment. And then found my way into TV because I realised that the thing that I particularly liked doing was talking to people and asking questions, but I also liked the subject that I had studied, and got work experience as a junior researcher at the BBC, unpaid, so that was tricky as well. But managed to kind of make enough contacts and connections, and an assistant producer who was also working on this program said, "Oh, I'll film some stuff for you." I mean, now you could just do it on your smartphone and it'd look pretty good. Whereas then you actually needed an actual camera and it was on videotape. I sent videotapes to people to say, "Hello, I'd like to be a presenter. Could you consider me?" And because I'd been a junior researcher, I'd had a whole cupboard full of other people's showreels, and I took some home each night and watched them and went, "Oh, OK, that works. That doesn't work. That works. That doesn't work." And so I kind of managed to put together a showreel that showcased my skills, I guess, talking about sometimes science, sometimes history, but in a kind of personable way. I think that's my USP.
I'm delighted to hear that you can care for your grandmother and then go on to have a cool career. It personally relates to me. Do you mind sharing a little bit about that, a sort of your care, your relationship with care and your caring journey, as it were?
Yeah, so she, I grew up in Cheshire and she was living in Greater Manchester, and I'd moved to Cambridge for uni and then London because I was going out with a man who is now my husband who lived in London. It just felt like the obvious place to go rather than to move back home, which felt like it would be kind of doing a U-turn. But as she got progressively older, and I think the clinical term is complex comorbidities, is that the one where basically a lot of things are going on all at once, but she was resolute that she didn't really want help unless, well, even though she needed it, she didn't want help. Mm-hmm. And she was a Polish speaker, so she came over to the UK after the end of the Second World War, and as she got older she lost more and more of her English. And I had never learned Polish properly. And so we spoke to each other in this kind of like weird pidgin where we would go to Morrisona, which is like a kind of, it's saying Morrison's, but in a Polish accent, which is charming now, but it was frustrating at the time. And she'd kind of be trying to tell me things over the phone about something that had happened in her flat and I couldn't understand. And honestly, I spent so many hours driving up and down the M1 and the M6, sometimes dreading what was going to be at the other end, and sometimes just, I don't know, I think a lot of carers will probably recognise that feeling of like love and commitment and duty, but also a bit of resentment. Like, I had plans and I've got to just chuck, they all got binned and now I've got to drive up and just sort stuff out. One of the things that was really amazing actually was a social worker eventually, oh my goodness, there was a social worker who kind of got it and came and said, "These are the things you need to say, these are the things you need to say in meetings with people." And that kind of, there are sort of like key terms that unlocked more care. But the thing that was really difficult was she was increasingly housebound, she was increasingly frail, she was very vulnerable. The area that she was in wasn't really the kind of area that people kind of looked out for each other. So she was kind of on her own. She was very much on her own. And they finally kind of put in 15-minute care visits at the beginning and the end of each day, which my grandmother was like really resistant to and would not be particularly cooperative. It's that difficult thing, isn't it, where you feel such love and care for someone and yet feel like you're not just battling the system, but you're, for me, it was the first time that I was a carer And for her, it was the first time that she needed care.
As an anthropologist, how do you view care in society? How has it developed? It feels like it's a pretty central thing in most societies, but it feels like sometimes it's less so in others. I wonder how you view it, how you view care in society as an anthropologist.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I feel like we in the UK or kind of the industrialised West, however we want, the global North, however we want to call it, where there are various versions of a kind of a state that might be able to provide some care, or there's a kind of a professional caring provision, whether that is or isn't actually available in terms of finance and capacity is this kind of separate question. But there is a such a thing as someone who gets paid to do caring in a professional capacity. It's really interesting, that kind of whole conversation about kind of how you quantify and incorporate risk in personal choices in what is the right answer. And the other thing is a kind of autonomy and individual choice making, and who gets to decide what the right thing to do is. And I think we now in our culture we're in a kind of new chapter where old people get to choose, or people with disabilities, and rightly, I'm not critiquing this, but it hasn't always been that way. There's been, for a long time, all of us have laboured under this belief that, you know, that kind of that idea of the arc, that you go from being an infant to being infantilised, and that's the right thing. That's how it should be. That when you're an old person, you need babying and you need nannying and you need your bum wiped and all the stuff. Or if you have a physical disability or learning disability, you're kind of not an adult. You're a child in an adult's body, perhaps, but you don't have the capacity to decide, and we know what's best for you. And we're going to talk over your head. And obviously this is horrific for people, and it always has been. But only now are we seeing the advocacy to kind of change that, not just change the conversation, but actually change the mindset and kind of focus on person-centered care. But person-centered care requires an understanding in a kind of cultural way of individual autonomy, which isn't something that you see in all societies. I mean, you could kind of say, well, if community or the family, however you imagine that, maybe not a nuclear family, but an extended family, if that's the decision-making body rather than an individual, I decide when I change my pad and I decide whether I live at home, or I want to decide, at least, even if I don't always get to. You have to kind of like change the mindset. So I think care in different cultural contexts comes out in very different ways, in the same way that child rearing does. I mean, there's a kind of fundamental universal, which is a baby is born and then it becomes an adult, more or less a functioning adult in that community. But anthropologists generally point out, and I think it's absolutely right, our species is hugely social and hugely variable culturally. There's one way of being a mallard duck or, you know, a flamingo or something like that. But there is such a multitude of ways of being human. And more when we look at how people nurture their children, we see what happens is that you create the kind of child that is culturally appropriate for the culture it's going to live in. And I think in the context of care, sometimes we kind of think, oh, it must be better in a kind of traditional or small scale society where the local extended family is nearby, that people are handy. You're not off doing a kind of a wage slave job somewhere and then having to outsource the care to another. Maybe, but not always in a way that would make sense for us. There's kind of plenty of anthropological examples where old people are, members of the community, if they are considered to not be functional, they get sent off into the forest and expected not to come back, or taken down to the river at flood time and left, you know, that kind of stuff. Where we kind of go, my goodness, that's terrible, because we romanticise small scale societies and think it must have been beautiful and wonderful. And if only we could capture some of that and bring it back and make it make sense in our context. But actually, caring is hard. Caring for little ones, caring for people with complex needs, caring for older people. It's a kind of a relationship, but it's also a job of work.
Can I move you on then, Ariane? How has caring evolved so from Paleolithic sort of times? I mean, it seems that there must have been some caring going on, as you're saying, but looking after somebody that perhaps had broken their leg, or I mean, what has, you know, how has caring evolved?
Well, we actually see evidence of quite complex care in species other than our own as well. So Neanderthals, you know, generally kind of considered to be like knuckle-dragging cave dwellers, actually really closely related, the most closely related species to us that's ever existed. Really probably very intelligent, probably used language in similar ways to our early ancestors, sapiens, so interbred with humans, with Homo sapiens all the time. And so most of us have 2-3% of Neanderthal DNA. There was a lot of, you know, getting jiggy with the cousins. And we see loads of evidence of Neanderthals, fossilised skeletons. This species kind of was in existence from about 400,000 to about 40,000 years ago. So died out, I mean, it sounds like a long time ago, but not that long ago. And we see evidence that not only was there kind of short-term intensive care for people who were injured, because what we see is very, for example, like a very complex broken leg, where when you're a hunter-gatherer in a kind of frozen tundra, if you break your leg and you don't have someone else helping, you're going to die. And we see that they've healed these breaks, these fractures. We see that injuries have repaired. And so we know that people must have been looked after. and then we also see older individuals where they must have had kind of complex and progressively debilitating conditions related to getting older, and that they appear to have continued for a long enough time such that someone else was probably foraging food for them, maybe even like chewing up or pounding food, because if you've got very poor teeth or your teeth have fallen out, how are you eating unless someone else is helping prepare food that you can actually digest? And then there's this amazing example, and it's a skeleton called Shanidar 1, and it was found in a site called Shanidar in Iraq now, and it's from about 40,000 years ago. And this individual, it was a male, and at some point at quite a young age, maybe 3-4, something like that, kind of like real juvenile, they had some kind of, they got hit on the head and it crushed their skull, and it caused a damage to their left eye, possibly blinded them. And the brain area that controls the right side of the body, so the kind of left side of the brain, basically got a serious brain injury. And so it caused their right side to wither and paralyze. So what you can see on the skeleton is a kind of like really robust, Neanderthals were kind of big, chunky versions of us, a really robust left arm and a withered right arm, and possible paralysis, and similar for the right leg and foot. But this person lived until they were 35 to 45. And so they were looked after, not only in that first instance of a very serious injury as a child, but probably for their whole life. Now, that's not to say that they were helpless. They may have been doing loads of super important work within the camp, within the group. For example, things like preparing fibres, preparing food. Someone else might go and hunt the horse, but you're, you know, perfectly capable of cutting it up or cooking it or managing the fire or looking after the kids or sharpening the stone tools, whatever it is. So I think that's the other thing that we have to remember, that disability was much more ubiquitous in the past. You know, you break your leg and there's not a surgeon waiting to put pins in it and plate it and give you anti. I mean, if you survive the infection, then you're on to a winner. And I think at a time, you know, pre universal development of this is what clothes look like because you've gone to TK or Primark or wherever and bought it. If everything's getting handmade, if you need a special shaped cup to hold, then someone will make a cup that fits your hand. If you have a scoliosis, everybody is having their clothes handmade, and so it would just be tailored to fit you. So there wasn't really the expectation that bodies and people behaved in kind of universal, homogenous ways. There was much more capacity for like genuine deep inclusion. We are hypersocial. We learn from one another. We see beyond just the immediate here and now so that we can think generationally. So there are some cultures where your role is to be a good ancestor. So it's not just about looking after grandma because, or your mum, because she looked after you when you were a kid. It's like, well, what is it that not only I owe to my children or to my grandparents, but to my great, great, great grandparents, because I am only here because of them. And that kind of cyclical view of time means that this is a moment in the kind of the dance rather than a thing you have to do to get on to the next thing. And so it doesn't make the realities of caring within a society that is not structurally designed to enable people to hold those important things equally in their minds and in their time. But it is a thing that I hope that sometimes kind of gives you that moment of reassurance in like the dark, dark night, the long night where you're wide awake because you're worried about money, you're worried about the person, you're worried about everything that you're holding in your head, to kind of say there are different ways of doing this and this is deeply, deeply innate to what I should be doing as a member of Homo sapiens.
If we move on to one of your other roles, which is as the president of the CPRE, which is the Countryside Charity, for those that don't know, you've described sort of time out in green space as being a wonder drug. And what does being outdoors do for you? And why do you advocate so passionately for it?
I think for me, it is that visceral connection. It's I feel happiest outdoors. I feel like I'm the most able to be myself and come back into all the roles that I have and have, as you know, the most to give, the most to be able to kind of like deal with, like my capacity. The cup is full of good and I can cope with carrying more on my shoulders, I guess. And I think there's a whole body of evidence that shows that connection to nature, green and blue spaces, is hugely powerful. It reduces cortisol, it reduces heart rate, you get a kind of a long tail in terms of benefits. So that even a kind of a short exposure to being outdoors can have a very long-term benefit. Like literally over days there will be benefit. People in hospital beds who can see the outside and see something natural, even if it's just a pigeon sitting on the roof opposite, generally tend to recover more quickly and report that they feel better and they feel more themselves than people who are in internal spaces and they can't see anything that is natural.
It's vital. I walk every single day, rain or shine or snow, or usually rain because I'm in Rochdale, before work. And it's dark and it's miserable and it's muddy, but it's the best time of the day. And then it usually goes downhill from there. And then I hike when I can up on the moors every weekend just to get out. And it's vital, like you say. I think I hope every carer has some ability at some point to just get outside just for a few minutes, because it's so important. Like, it's become such a must-do. I mean, obviously, if the day goes to hell, it goes to hell. But if it's I try and make it a non-negotiable. I think Katie as well, right? You walk as well, don't you, to just get away from it all.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm lucky. I've got a friend who lives a couple of doors away, and we go off. We do the same walk every single time, but then we're looking at the changes in nature. We've got a bird app, so we can listen to the song and work out which bird it is, which has added something exciting. So we've used a bit of technology, but it's added something to our walks. And I go with, takes the most phenomenal photos. And so we've got like this record of all of our walks that we're doing. It's lovely.
Oh, that's wonderful. But I think the other thing is that lots of people who are cared for don't have access to the outdoors. Certainly people in rural communities, you know, where mobility isn't necessarily as easy, they might have spent the best part of every day outdoors and now they're stuck inside. Or young adults or youngsters with learning disabilities, that they might, you know, get a trip to the shops, but what if they don't want to go to the shops? What if they want to go up onto the moors like you do, Laura? And I think what we have as well is people, again, we've kind of come full circle to that kind of conversation about risk. If you say the outdoors is for everyone and that I, as I'm able-bodied, I don't have any learning disabilities, and I am permitted by society to make a decision that I can go and do this challenging hike and that I will be able to recognise the risks and off I go. And I can make that decision for my children, perhaps, as long as we've got the right waterproofs and we've got snacks, whatever, off we go. But the decisions around someone with learning disabilities might be very different. Like, oh, that's dangerous, or they might get wet, or they'll get muddy feet, or it's slippery. And you go, yeah. So that doesn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to do that. That's something that is wonderful. You know, my grandma, we just sat up on the top of a hill. She was in Manchester, so we went up onto the top of the moors and it was blistering wind. And she absolutely loved it because we kind of found bilberries. I went and picked some bilberries and we sat on this kind of perched on this freezing wall. And honestly, we both felt so invigorated and it was just infinitely, infinitely better than spending another half hour arguing about whether I should or shouldn't go to the laundrette to wash all her sheets. You know, just, oh, let's not do that. Let's just get in the car and just go for a drive, even maybe with the windows down.
Do you think if we sort of had a society that cared more about our outdoor spaces and our nature, you know, we'd be more mindful about care itself, because if we're not looking after our outdoor spaces and we're not cognizant of valuing, preserving that sort of stuff, then there's not much chance for care at the end of that list, is there?
I love the idea. I feel like someone should, like, we should really delve into this idea. But I feel like, yes, there is something absolutely integral and related to caring for your place and caring for your people. And when you're divorced and isolated from the place in which you live and what's happening out there, and you don't feel empowered to care, to show your care, it's hard as well to show your care and to reach out and say, I need care now. And we are caring together. So that idea again of, are we putting the focus of meeting needs and having needs met in the individual, or are we, can you zoom out and actually say it is the community's responsibility to ensure that the community's needs are met? And within that are visiting people, make sure that, you know, people are mobile, that they're safe at home, that they've got food, that they've got someone to talk to, that they're involved in the cultural life of the place in which they live. So it's a community responsibility, not an individual responsibility. So that kind of hierarchy of needs is sort of turned on its head, because you say none of these individual things can be met unless we meet the deeper needs, and the community acknowledges that it's our responsibility collectively, not in terms of individuals or nuclear families, to sort these things out for this individual.
We could talk to you for hours, but we're running out of time. Thank you so much for speaking with us today, Marianne. Where can our listeners go to find out more about you and your work?
So I have a website, marianneohotta.com. That's O-C-H-O-T-A. I am on Instagram and LinkedIn. Yeah, and I guess you could find me on the internet because there's like TV shows and radios and podcasts and stuff that you can find as well. And I've got a few books as well. If you want hints and tips on things to go and spot in the countryside, then I've written a book about that as well.
What's the book called? We'll put the what are the books called, and we'll put the notes in the show description.
That's very kind of you. One's called Hidden Histories: A Spotter's Guide to the British Landscape, and that's all about different landscape features that you can spot in the landscape around you. And then the other one is called Secret Britain, which is about archaeological mysteries, so sites and artifacts. And that's kind of a kind of full colour thing. So that's not a kind of a gazetteer to help you kind of get out and about. You can sit in the comfort of your armchair or back garden and kind of look at the kind of amazing pictures of these sites and artifacts where we know certain things, but there's a kind of overriding question of like, why were they doing that? And the book that I'm working on at the moment is a history of our species. So, but that's not out yet because I haven't finished writing it.
Gosh, that sounds exciting. It sounds like a lot of work as well. Sounds big.
Yeah, I thought I kind of foolishly thought that I'd be able to like dash it off and it'd be easy, and I'm still working on it.
Well, let us know when it's out we'll give it a shout out because it sounds fascinating. Well, thank you again so much for speaking with us today, and thank you so much to everybody for listening. Please follow, rate and subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts.
We'd love to hear from you, whether it's questions, guest suggestions, or anything else. So please email us at wearecarers, which is all one word, @gmail.com. And until next time.
Until next time.